and the blue line, and so people are slightly delayed, but they'll be rolling in, and I didn't want to lose the opportunity with our two congressmen to get going with this very, very important discussion. And so first of all, I would like to thank all of you for coming. I'm delighted you're here. And I especially want to thank Congressman Smith and Congressman Thornberry for taking time out of their calendar. I think it's really quite valuable for us to be able to hear from them. The two of them have been pioneering some very, very important work, which they're going to describe to you very shortly, on creating a new instrument for the United States. Let me just say a word that I've been hanging around the Congress for a little over 30 years. And it's very interesting, a couple of observations. It's interesting to see these are two members of the rising generation. You know, I mean, Congress is a kind of a gerontocracy with a lot of people asking how long are they willing to hang on until they can become leaders. But there is a transition where you start seeing the new generation of leaders step forward on big ideas. Most of the stuff that Congress does every day, and I did a lot of it, you know, it's not big ideas. But occasionally you get a chance to work on truly big ideas. And these two men have decided they're going to tackle a big idea. Now, big ideas take a long time. The Clean Air Act took 11 years working on the floor of the House and the Senate before the Clean Air Act was. Food stamps took 14 years before we got food stamps discovered. Big ideas take time. You know, big ideas take time. Every development, political development in the country that ends up in a policy starts off in one person's brain. And the whole art of politics is taking that one idea in one person's brain and then broadening it to the degree that it can become a policy for the whole country. And this only happens when you get true leadership coming from members of Congress that want to devote a considerable amount of their time working on that big idea. It's a very small percentage of members of Congress that are willing to do that. Most of them spread themselves far too thinly across too many issues and therefore don't become genuine leaders in anything. But what you're looking at today are two real leaders, people that are going to make an enormous difference. I've been watching them both for some time. I've gotten over my resentment that they're so much younger than I am. But that's a more common phenomenon I have to live through all the time these days. And I've had the opportunity to work with both of them on other occasions. Most recently, Congressman Thornberry was on our Smart Power Commission and brought to that commission the idea of this Corporation for Public Diplomacy. It is truly a big idea. And the most important thing is the two of them are trying to pioneer a truly integrated approach to America's future in dealing with public diplomacy. And what we've realized is that the politics of Washington frequently gets in the way of the message for the country. And they're trying to find a path to this. So this is going to be an extremely interesting session. I'm delighted they're both here. Thank you for taking the time. I know it's very hard to carve out time, especially to get off of Capitol Hill. We're really delighted to have you here. Steve, do you want to say anything further to open up? And then
I think you should go right to the program.
Shall we do that? So, Congressman Smith, you're going to be the first.
Okay.
You can either do it from there or you can do it up here, whatever you want to do.
I'll just
take right there.
Do it from here if that's all right. Just started. I've started our congressional baseball game. Once a year, people who are too old to be doing that sort of thing do it. And standing up and sitting down right now as a result of the practices is actually more work than it might appear. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. And I want to thank CSIS, first of all, for holding this forum, because one of the things that both Mac and I are very interested in doing is getting more attention to this issue. And in this town, that is a slow, patient, persistent process. You need help. You need forums like this to get the discussion going and to get people to focus on it. And on this and many, many other issues, CSIS has just done a fabulous job of focusing that attention. And also, I really want to thank Mac for the working relationship that we've had on the Armed Services Committee. The first 10 years that I was in Congress, I was in the minority, he was in the majority. In the last two, it's been the other way around. But we've always worked very well together on these issues, past the normal partisanship, and really sort of looked at it in a substantive way. What can we do to sort of advance policy interests instead of what can we do to torture each other on a daily basis? And as entertaining as that can be, it's not terribly productive for the country. And particularly in this area, we feel that the policy is so important that we need to try to work as hard as possible together across party lines, bringing in many folks from our committee and beyond to try to come up with a good policy. And there are a number of different pieces to it. We're focusing the subcommittee that I chair and that Max, the ranking member, on is on terrorism and unconventional threats. So in general, we're looking at, how do we confront the terrorist threat? And there are a lot of different things that you do there. Certainly, there is a very prominent direct action piece. We have jurisdiction over the Special Operations Forces, have visited them all over the world in their work and met with them and focused on a lot of the efforts that they are doing on not just a direct action, taking out high-value targets, but also broader counterinsurgency efforts. And that is a huge part of what we're going to need to do in order to defeat Al-Qaeda and the violent extremists. But the other piece of it, as we continued to work on that, that we sort of came across, was the idea that this is an ideological struggle. It's not just, one team against the other team, and we're going to fight it out until one wins. There's a whole lot of folks in the middle who are being influenced by the way the debate around a wide range of issues is covered. And how are we communicating that? How are we fighting that ideological war to communicate, not just that, all right, we're going to go out and we're going to get the guys who have decided to join the violent extremists, but how do we stop more people from wanting to join them in the first place? And there's pieces to that as well. Certainly, I think development assistance is very important, but the way you communicate your message on those issues is very important. And in this sense, I think it is somewhat analogous to the Cold War and the struggle we went through in that situation. I mean, analogies are dangerous. Everybody wants to sort of analogize the fight against Al-Qaeda to their favorite issue, and I don't want to get too comprehensive about it. But part of what we did in fighting the Soviet Union and fighting communism was we figured out how to communicate the message that our plan, capitalist democracy and freedom, was better than theirs. And how do we, get that message out to people in a coordinated fashion? And the problem, since 9/11, we have not really done the work in our government or with other governments in a cooperative fashion to build that broad-based strategic communications message. Now, it strikes us at first as very simple. I mean, clearly we have more to offer people than the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. In terms of, just basic human freedoms and economics, but that doesn't always come across. How do we coordinate to make sure that we're doing everything necessary to take advantage of strategic communications opportunities? Part of it is messaging. What do we say? But part of it also is that cooperation piece. And the last thing I'm going to say before I turn it over to Mac, just by way of how we coordinate this, and actually I want to say one thing about what we've done in the defense authorizing bill, is the easiest way that I can think about this is any sort of message that you're trying to deliver, and for me that's a campaign, that's my framework, but if you've ever worked on Madison Avenue selling a product, it's the same thing, or tried to win a case before a jury, you basically have to figure out, you have to develop your message, and you have to deliver it to the people who you want to deliver it to. And those are three very simple pieces. At first glance, but also very complicated. Because first of all, what is your message? What are we trying to say to those populations out there that might be inclined to join Al-Qaeda and violent extremists? How do we communicate that message? I said I wouldn't reference this, but I will because it fits in here. We had a debate on the House floor yesterday about the controversy over what even basically to call our enemy. And this has been an ongoing debate since 9/11. Mac and I have been in London and talked with some of their leaders over there, and they went through the same sort of struggle. We went through the whole Islamo-fascist, came up with the war on terror, but it matters, because if you call them jihadists, you are helping them. That is a very positive thing, not just to people who are sympathetic to Al-Qaeda, but to the entire Muslim world. So getting that message right in the first place is very important. And then there's delivery, and this is what's getting really difficult. I remember when I ran my state Senate campaign in 1990, couldn't afford television, it was direct mail. So you did direct mail, that's where people got their information. Now, they're getting their information all over the place, off the internet, off cable news, and you have to understand your population that you're going after. Where do they get their information? There was a project that I'm reasonably confident isn't top secret, but we were developing a comic book that sort of made the anti-violent extremist argument. because that was where a lot of people were getting their information, or a video game that, that sort of, you know, that, that laid out that argument. So how do people form their opinions? And then, of course, there is the, you know, picking the audience part, you know, and that's going to vary from place to place. It's going to be a different message in Afghanistan and Pakistan than it is in Iraq, than it is in Europe, than it is elsewhere. And to do that, you need a comprehensive effort. And that's what we are trying to do, and what we are have put into the defense authorizing bill that we passed in the House, is a requirement for the administration to put together an interagency plan to coordinate strategic communication efforts. Because there are, you know, in Washington, D.C., several dozen different groups that would have a piece of this, that have an element of it. And the guys at SOCOM are doing something, the guys at the State Department are doing something, and then, of course, our allies are, you know, developing their own messages as well. Who's in charge of trying to coordinate that so that we don't have 55 different efforts going on in 55 different directions and become self-defeating? And there are models in government. Now, I will grant you that most of the models for trying to develop interagency cooperation are models for how not to do it. That didn't work too well. I think of the Department of Homeland Security off the top of my head. But it does work occasionally. I believe, in my opinion, the National Counterterrorism Center that was developed post 9/11 that went out and said, okay, we got a lot of people working on this. Let's stop the stovepiping. Let's get the CIA and the NSA and Department of Defense. Let's get everybody at least in one area where they're working together to track the problem. And I think it has built layers of communication and cooperation that have helped us in our pursuit of high-value targets. What we believe is that we need to do the same thing for strategic communications. And obviously, the tough part of that job off the top is, who's involved? Who's got a piece here? The second really tough part is then, you know, how do you coordinate them? Who do you put in charge? But we have to at least try, because right now our broader message in the ideological war, our strategic communications, is occasionally good, frequently awful, but almost never coordinated. It is just bouncing off all over the place, and we've had, you know, meetings in our hearings with a variety of different people, and, you know, some of them I think were pretty smart. Some of them would come up with some good stuff, and we sort of dived down and said, okay, well, who do you answer to? How do you coordinate this? And they're like, well, you know, I just got my department, and that's what we're doing in my department. We need to get past that. That's what we're trying to do in our bill. MAC also had a piece in there to try to get also some help from outside private agencies, think tanks, people like CSIS, to sort of examine this issue and give us some ideas as to how we can better deliver that message and develop it. So that's what we're working on. I truly believe it is probably the most important part of winning the ideological war against violent extremists, because we can't kill them all. We can't. They'll keep coming if we don't have a message that says, this is, you know, this is why you shouldn't even go down that path. There is a better way to develop yourself in civilized society. We need to win the ideological war if we're going to win the broader war against violent extremism. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Representative Thornberry.
I think it's important to start out just by noting that it is, despite what you may think, there are parts in Congress where Republicans and Democrats really do work together. It sometimes doesn't make the headlines, but it does happen, and thanks to Adam's leadership on our subcommittee, it happens regularly and constantly with our subcommittee. So I appreciate his leadership in making that possible. I also appreciate CSIS. I've had a number of interactions with Dr. Hamry and his organization over the years. I always benefit from them. Usually I benefit more when I'm listening rather than when I'm talking. But nonetheless, I appreciate any sort of opportunity. Dr. Hamry mentioned one of the opportunities I had was to work on the Smart Power Commission, co-chaired by Dr. Joseph Nye of Harvard, and y'all may well know his view is that power is the ability to affect and influence others, and you can do it in one of three ways. There are threats, coercions, and other sticks. There are payments, inducements, and other carrots. And then there's the third category, which he calls soft power, which is attracting others to you without paying for the carrots or the sticks. And I think that what we're talking about today fits into that third category. Smart power was the right mix of those things, being able to have all the tools in the toolbox available to you. And my view, and Adam touched on this, is that increasingly, for national security especially, we have to work across these horizontal lines of this is my bailiwick, this is your bailiwick. We have to do things across the lines because those sort of categories are not so neat and orderly and do not fit the world we live in anymore. For me, the aha moment was not too long after September 11th, when we realized that this was not a small group of criminals that we could just go capture or take out in some way, that this had a broader ideological element to it. And if we think we could kill or capture them all, and we try to do that, we're going to create as many as we take out. And so one approach to this was not going to be successful. We had to have the broader approach to be successful. Adam mentioned, I think, during the Cold War, we all kind of understood that. There was an ideological element. We had not only broadcasting with Voice of America and things, but we had a lot of people who studied Russian history and the Soviet Union and how it to understand it, in order to carry out that ideological struggle. And I think since the end of the Cold War, that when we is not so clearly us versus them, that kind of ideological component to some of the national security challenges we face has been diminished somewhat. And I think that's what we're getting at. That's what smart power in a lot of ways is about. So what are we talking about? I found a few years ago as I was working on defense transformation that it really depended on who was talking on how they defined transformation. It could easily be defined in a way that sounded silly. And I think strategic communications is subject to lots of different definitions and misuses, and depending on where you sit, it means a lot of different things. I do not think it means clever marketing. I do not think it means simplistic slogans. I do not think it means for looking for better ways to tell the world how great we are. It's got to be much larger than all that. Colonel Eikenberry in Middle East Quarterly a few years ago said it synchronizes actions that include public diplomacy, public affairs, public relations, outreach, information operations, and psychological operations includes but not limited to those things. He says it's the overarching concept that unifies and focuses the right message to the right audience with the intent to shape perceptions. And that's where I think we need to focus, the right message to the right audience with the intent and to help shape their perceptions, not only of us, but of their environment and particularly the bad guys. As with all successful communications, I believe it starts with listening and understanding. And that means you really have to study the history, the culture, the fears and anxieties, the hopes of different cultures and civilizations. And if you don't really understand that, then you're not going to be able to develop the successful messages to be able to communicate them in an effective way. You need to understand the networks of influence, which are different, for example, in different parts of the Muslim world or in different regions. So why is all this important? I thought one of the best lines was in one of Thomas Friedman's writings where he says, the greatest restraint on human behavior is not a police officer or a fence, it's the culture in which he lives. And so what a lot of this boils down to is helping to shape perceptions in that culture, understanding that we're not going to be able to tell people what to think, but on the other hand, we're not willing to sit on the sidelines either. If you don't believe the good guys, you can believe the bad guys. The well-known letter from Zawahiri to Zakari that was found in Iraq in 2005 said more than half this battle is taking place in the battlefield of the media. And if you look at the time and effort and sometimes the risk Al-Qaeda puts into tapes and broadcasts and other groups put into internet and so forth, they clearly know that this is a key part of the battlefield. The other thing, though, and one of the reasons that I think it's so important for us to push this now is we have an opportunity. Y'all may have seen Newsweek a couple weeks ago where it talked about that a critique of radicalism is building within the heart of the Muslim world. People are stepping back. You look at opinion polls on bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, they are fallen and have fallen significantly over the past year. So there are other voices rising up saying maybe it's not okay to blow yourself up and kill a bunch of innocents after all. Maybe that's not what jihad calls us to do. So there's an opportunity as people are beginning to question and think. We need to take advantage, I think, of those opportunities. So how do we do it? I think Adam put it very well. I don't know who it was. Some foreign diplomat was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, how can one man in a cave manage to out-communicate the world's greatest communication society? That's maybe a little harsh, but on the other hand, I think nearly anybody, and there's a stack of studies this high that have looked at this and says we are not doing a very good job. Part of our problem is self-inflicted. As Adam mentioned, no one's in charge day to day. And the truth is, if you have got to coordinate and get approval and sign off on a message in the internet age, then you are too slow. It's not going to work that way to get all the interagency checkoffs. And the truth is, there is some stigma to even trying to communicate. People will label it propaganda, and sometimes that intimidates us. And so we decide not to engage in the ideological battlefield, which I think is a dangerous thing. As Adam mentioned, about 3 years ago, I introduced a bill to create a independent FFRDC, kind of like the RAND Corporation, to allow outside folks who didn't want to work for government to make contributions in this effort. And partly I borrowed an idea, which was in a Defense Science Board study in 2004, but partly I knew a person who had worked on campaigns, had made all the money he needed to make, and wanted to contribute his expertise to this larger national security effort. He didn't want to work for the federal government. He didn't want to contract with the federal government. He just wanted to be useful, and yet there was no way for him to really plug in. And so the idea that the Defense Science Board came up with is have this independent entity, that's separate from the government, but so that these folks, and we've got the best in the world, not only with campaigns, but advertising, different expertise with media, can make contributions so that we can harness some of the tremendous creativity and expertise that we have. So in this year's defense bill, under Adam's leadership, we have three provisions. One that says we need a strategy on how we're going to approach this. Secondly, we require the State Department and the Defense Department to lay down in writing their roles and responsibilities, who's doing what. And once you get it on paper and you start passing the papers between the two of them and it's, you start to really get to the nub of the matter. And thirdly, we require a study on setting up this outside entity to take advantage of the outside expertise. I would have liked to have done more. Obviously, you get into these jurisdictional constraints and other things. So we're pushing that at least to get more attention to the area. A couple other points right quick. One is I'm increasingly convinced that narratives and storytelling are keys to understanding cultures. And as you kind of dig down and listen to smart people on this topic, again, it's not come up with a great commercial about how great the USA is and broadcast it all over the Middle East. That's not particularly helpful. What you need to do is understand the stories that are part of that culture and weave your message into the stories that people already believe, that are part of their culture, that are consistent. As Adam says, that's like what you do when you tried to persuade a jury. It's what we do in running political campaigns. This may be about the only issue where an elected politician has some practical experience that may actually bear on the issue. It's kind of interesting. I mean, if we run campaigns, we got to make sure that it's truthful what we say. We pick a target audience. We figure out the most effective way to communicate with that audience. We need to stick with it. We can't be hopping over message to message to message. We have to stick with it long enough to make sure that it sinks in, and usually we're long sick of it by then. And it's got to be consistent with other messages that go out. People have talked in the United States government about our information fratricide, because everybody is not singing on the same page, which just dilutes the effect of anything we do. And it's got to be consistent with what people already know. So bottom line is, I think this is as an important part of national security as diplomacy or military action or foreign assistance. It is not something that's gotten the attention that it needs to. It cuts across too many jurisdictional and turf lines, and that makes it hard, but it is very, very important for our country's security. And I know, speaking for myself, I want to look for any way I can to help make sure that we are as capable as our country can be in pursuing this area of national security. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thornberry. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we have about 50 minutes for questions, and I think I look out in the audience, I see a number of seasoned practitioners, so I'm sure we'll have a very full discussion. I just ask you to wait for a microphone and identify yourself. But maybe just to get things started, I wanted to just pick up on the point that Mr. Thornberry was just ending on, that this is a complicated set of disciplines within the government: public affairs, public diplomacy, strategic communications, PSYOPs. A lot of different disciplines that are very both protective and concerned about sort of filtering across their lines, as you said, the importance of public affairs officers to be truthful versus PSYOPs officers who are in a different business. But I wondered, as you look out at the, I wanted to draw you both out perhaps to comment on the issue of who should be the ultimate coordinator in this, and I, not to suggest that you want to try to tell the President how to micromanage the operation, but does this have to be a White House function because of the varying disciplines and the dispersal of authorities within the government? Who should be the ultimate coordinator of the message and in terms of the coordination of strategic communications efforts overall? Do you think that has to be a White House function, or can it be sorted out through clarifying authorities and some other kind of coordination mechanism?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is I wouldn't prejudge that by saying this is what I mean. The purpose of our bill is to have that very question examined, among others, and, you know, I'd like to have, you know, people a lot smarter than me look at it, talk about it, think about it, have that experience and come up with that answer. So our goal here isn't to say this is the way it needs to be exactly. I mean, off the top, you know, my analogy was to the Counterterrorism Center. Obviously, that is, you know, that did come directly out of the White House, but also out of, you know, Congress formed it and, you know, put the White House in charge of it. It would strike me that that's probably where it would wind up being, like a national security advisor or like those others. But, you know, it could turn out to be something within the State Department or within the DOD. I mean, once you sort of peel back the, you know, the bureaucracy there and start looking at who's doing what, I know the guys at SOCOM are doing, you know, quite a bit of work in this area as part of their, as the lead agency within DOD on the GWAT. That is possible. So I wouldn't want to prejudge it, but yes, off the top, I would say likely it would be White House.
Yeah, I don't know for sure either the best way to do it. In our Smart Power Commission report, we said it was probably a mistake to abolish USIA, but that does not necessarily mean recreating USIA is the answer to fixing things. And, you know, we've tried to do this a couple times since 9/11, Department of Homeland Security, where you take all the people who do similar things, bring them together under one department. That's had problems. The creating the Director of National Intelligence has been another example. where we gave him some authority to direct these various entities across 16 different organizations, but probably not enough authority to really make things happen if you step back and look at it. So I think Adam's point about the NCTC is a good example where day-to-day operations, things do work pretty well, I think. It is under the DNI as far as budgets and so forth, but it has enough clout in order to stretch across the bureaucracy. Probably something like that does make the most sense. But if I make one other point, Adam mentions, he talks about the military folks who do this, and obviously psychological operations are part of a tactical decision that military folks have to make, you know, when they are conducting operations. The interesting analogy back to us is, I hope I'm not giving away secrets here, but one of the things we've been warned about in this election campaign is there are no tactical local election issues. When everybody in the room may have a cell phone that can video what I say, I may think I'm talking to a small group of Republican women in Amarillo, Texas, but it can be on the internet like that, and it can be an issue that McCain has to deal with. So the warning to us is be careful what you say. The same is true here, I think, that there are no tactical operations that are limited in size because it can be worldwide like that. And so the importance not only of coordinating kind of the big message with state, DOD, intelligence, et cetera, is there, but that's got to reach down at so the at the tactical level, everybody is on the same page, or else you do have that information fratricide that can occur.
Okay, questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Bob Tuohy from the Homeland Security Institute, which is the DHS's FFRDC. And we are right now working counter-radicalization issues for both DOD and DHS, although admittedly just scratching the surface. We know enough already, though, that we think it's got huge potential and it's something that ought to be looked at. So I was really gratified to hear what you guys have done. My question, though, is simple. We share your pain on the interagency process, but there's also some pain on the Hill. Have you been socializing this with your Homeland Security Committee colleagues? And if so, are you getting any traction?
Well, Mac referenced, you know, part of the problem, you know, we were just having in terms of not being able to go as far as we wanted in the bill. Because of some interjurisdictional stuff, and a lot of that's the Foreign Affairs Committee. But I guess the short answer at this point is we have not had a great deal of coordination between our different committees, but that certainly is something that I think we should work on as we build towards a larger message.
Yeah, I'd just say Adam's on Foreign Affairs as well as Armed Services. I'm on Intelligence as well as Armed Services. So among the three, I think we are trying to push and bring attention to this issue. And what we were able to even put in this bill was because of Adam's work with Foreign Affairs that enabled it to get there. Obviously, Homeland Security is the other big one that as far as committees that need to be brought into it. We have our own challenges, as you well know, on the Hill. Homeland Security of anybody would know. And clearly that needs to be worked out too.
I think in the internet age, you have to, the domestic message and the international message has to obviously be coordinated because the same
Absolutely.
People are reading the same blogs and the same websites.
Absolutely.
And just one final thing, then we got other questions. I think we need to also be careful about it. I mean, we can all have this sort of flow chart vision of how, you know, you're going to pull the organization together and then you're going to, it's not going to happen. I mean, no matter how you do it, what we want to do is not sort of to get to that perfect point, but get to the point where everybody is a little closer to the same page and it's coordinated. And even if you're not under the same flow chart, you sort of know what the broad objectives are, and then you start working together in a more close way without having it be exactly with one guy up there who's in charge of all of it, because it's too big to do that.
Yes, Ambassador Courtney.
Of USIA into the department. The idea was that in the country team and embassies, the public affairs officer is at the table with the ambassador and the other representatives in the takeoff for policy development within the country. But in Washington, USIA was isolated and not always in the Situation Room when major policy was being made, and instead USA was often told after the policy was made to go out and sell it. That said, with the integration, it could probably work either way, but there have been a series of less than fully effective undersecretaries for public diplomacy, and that has undermined it. In a broader perspective, probably the best solution, and I say this as someone who was in the former Soviet Union after the Soviet collapse, is an order of magnitude increase in funding for public diplomacy. For example, when the Soviet Union collapsed, some were wondering, well, should we create an American University of Cairo or American University of Beirut, which was so effective in that region? Should we create that in that part of the world? And the answer was the funding just wasn't there for that. So funding rebalancing is probably, you know, one of the issues that's most important.
Great. Yeah, no, I think that's true. One person who's written on this says, actually, we have three issues. One is institutional ineffectiveness. One is lack of strategic direction, which is what we've been talking about, and insufficient resources. I think all three of those things have to be worked on and addressed to make a successful effort. There's no question resources are part of it.
I guess I would very quickly make a budget point. I have a very long speech on this, which I will spare you. But we right now have about 35 top priorities heading into the next presidency. This is a significant problem just in general, but it is an unbelievable problem because people don't seem to notice that. I mean, I go to hearings all day long on one subject after another. I haven't been to the one yet where people say, you know, we're spending too much money on that, we need to stop. You know, on health care, on energy, on public diplomacy, on defense, on down the line, you know, we all kind of agree that we need to spend billions more. We're $9 trillion in debt. Nobody's prioritizing. Nobody's talking about, you know, cutting entitlements. Well, not nobody, but not enough people are talking about it. As the largest portion of the budget, you know, we want to make the tax cuts permanent. You know, and do all these things. At some point, we got to have a serious discussion about this and map out what our priorities are and how we're going to go about actually finding the money. I say that like a reflexive tick every time money comes up when we're talking about issues, to try to spread the word if I can.
Yes, there's a question in the second back row there.
I'm Mark Randall from the Congressional Research Service. How important do you think it is that our message is coordinated with our allies, and to what extent do you think there's consensus between them and us about what the message should be?
Well, obviously, it should be coordinated and or at least consistent. We don't have to say the same things, and we don't have to say them in the same way, but it's better if they're not diametrically opposed to each other, because that has the effect of canceling each other out. I think Adam's point earlier was exactly right. Just think about how you get information now. Many sources, websites, broadcast, all of that. We're never going to have a perfect system where we are issued talking points and everybody says the same words. We're not going to have it within our government, within our country, and certainly not among allies who are trying to achieve the same thing. But on the other hand, we do need to be engaged in this ideological component, and we need to have mechanisms so that we can talk with the British about, you know, this is our theme and some of the approaches we want to use. And so you can coordinate, I think, at that level, so at least you don't knock each other's messages off the air.
I completely agree with that. And the one thing I would add, and I'm not 100% certain of this, but just based on some conversations in London and in Afghanistan with others, we're farther away from each other, we're farther away from our allies than is healthy right now. Now, again, no imagination here that we're going to get to the point where we're all on the same page. But, you know, I remember meeting with our commanders in Afghanistan, the problem of sort of building the NATO forces, you know, how do we get the forces to fight our fight? And he said, well, among many, many problems was, you know, the notion that they said, okay, we're fine fighting the counterinsurgency in Afghanistan, but don't drag us into the global war on terror. Which was like, ooh, okay. Thought you were kind of there already. So, and that is reflective of differing opinions. Well, at the end of the day, it's reflective of one thing. They think we're too militaristic in our approach. They may well be wrong about that, but we certainly, I think, need to get a lot closer to the same place so that our allies, you know, more often than not, view our actions as positive. I'm not, like I said, I'm not sure this is some cataclysmic problem. I'm sure, you know, a Democrat would claim that it was in a partisan argument. I'm not sure it's that bad, but it certainly is something that we could improve.
So, question over here, Harlan Ullman, on the first row here.
I'm Harlan Ullman at CSIS. You are on the side of the angels, but with due deference, the devil is in the detail. And in shorthand, one of the problems with our strategic communications can be put in terms of Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, torture renditions, Israel, and dealing with the factors that lead people to become suicide bombers. How would you deal with those particular issues, which are really the form of the grievances that really limit our strategic communications?
Well, to some degree, that expands upon what I just said, because that too is part of the international perception in terms of how we're pushing it. And it's hard, and I think the hardest thing about it is sort of what we were talking about earlier, what Mac referenced about how, you know, used to be able, you know, you make a speech somewhere and so on. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt could say the exact opposite thing to two different audiences, you know, in the same afternoon, and it would work beautifully, and he wouldn't have any problem. Yeah, it doesn't work, as we've all found out in this campaign, to a crazy level. And I reference that to this issue because, you know, if you go back and you look at some of the things that we fought, you know, with the Soviet Union, with World War II, I mean, what we're doing at Guantanamo, what we did at Abu Ghraib, really isn't that out of what we did in all the previous fights that we fought. You know, we've sort of created this image that somehow George W. Bush has gone running off. And I guess I should be thinking about that camera issue that we've been referencing at this point. But anyway, the point is, it's not as outlandish. The difference is, bam, I mean, they got the pictures on the internet, and it's and the propaganda war is there. So I don't think we were as thoughtful about that as we should have. I mean, I understand on a, you know, legal standpoint the argument that the administration was making on the issue of torture, okay? I don't agree with it, but I understand it. But forget the legal part. The fact that all over the world, you know, when John McCain, the nominee, was leading, you know, the fight to get this ban, that, you know, we were trying to get a ban on torture into legislation, and for whatever nuanced legal reason, the administration was opposed to it. Big frickin' strategic communications problem, and that never seemed to occur to anybody. So, you know, while we're trying to, and there's legitimate needs here, okay? You got to drop bombs occasionally. You got to, you know, you got to certainly lock up and to some degree interrogate prisoners. And there's always going to be propaganda on the other side. And those pieces are critical, you know, on the intel side to, you know, getting the intelligence we need that has helped make us successful in Iraq and elsewhere. How you balance those things is a lot tougher than I think people give it credit for. But I think it's clear right now that that's a big propaganda tool. Abu Ghraib, you know, the importance of that in terms of fueling the insurgency in Iraq and elsewhere, I don't think is very well understood. So I do think we need to take a little bit more time other than just saying, hey, you do what you got to do and let the chips fall where they may. I think it really does undermine that strategic communications message, and we have to find ways to better deliver that message.
Yeah, it was going to be a disaster however it was handled, but it was handled to make it worse than it could have been. I mean, I think that's what we're talking about. If you're set up with being able to make internet speed decisions dealing with strategic communications and the right media and so forth, then you will minimize the damage to an event like that or maximize the advantage to a different kind. There will always be events in the world that make it messier than it should be. And I think another point that's often made, which is absolutely true, is what you say is never going to be more important than what you do. And I mean, that is absolutely true. Even when it is true, though, you ought to do the best you can on what you say and how you say it and when and how fast and to help shape perceptions for maximum effectiveness.
And just one final point on that. We also have to understand that our enemies, you know, are not above lying about this stuff, and we need to push back harder in Afghanistan. I mean, if we attack a target before the bombs even hit the ground, the Taliban has spread a news story out there that we killed 35 civilians and 50 children. And, it, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's not true. And one of the problems we have is particularly the European press and even our press to some extent, they grab that stuff, it's in the paper, it's out there, and it's a propaganda tool, and it's not even true. And we have to figure out how to combat that a little bit better, too.
Yes, there's a question in the back row there.
Harold Rosenbaum, Centra. I resonate with your message that you're trying to give us, especially the analogy between a political campaign and getting a strategic message across. I would urge people to look at how we get into the 21st century with that and use digital communications for the polling processes, both prior to find out what people want to hear, and after you've delivered the message to find out if they heard what you wanted them to hear. Where I'm having a little trouble is how you're trying to implement this process with the addition of a new organization, whether it's an FFRDC or whatever other organizations you're talking about. It seems to me that we ought to have a rule in this country that says every time Congress institutes and creates a new organization, whether it's an outside organization or a committee, they should be required to get rid of another organization. So we stop this process of bundling organizations upon organizations, read the DNI.
A fair point, and I would support your rule, by the way. But I guess where I come from is you've got something that doesn't exist, say, and you're trying to get more attention to it. I am taking on two burdens if I've got to get rid of something and create something over here. It's tough enough just to create something new if I'm also trying to take away from all the interest for over here. It just makes it doubly tough to get it through. Doesn't mean it's not right. It is. But the question is, while you're fooling with that and trying to get the support to do away with these things while you're creating this, meanwhile, we don't have the capability. And so partly it's a matter of expediency where I come from. What can we do now that helps give the country this capability, and hopefully those other things can fade away, but I agree we don't have a good experience with it.
And also it's possible to not create a new agency on this, simply, fold the responsibilities into an existing agency, and that's certainly something you should look at. There's a lot of different ones out there. I mean, obviously, if you did that, you would have to expand that agency's capabilities and add money to it. It wouldn't be free, but you wouldn't necessarily have to totally create a new bureaucracy.
Yes, this is a question. Mark, this second.
Mark Jacobson, Senate Armed Services Committee. Congressman Thornberry, Congressman Smith, thank you very much for alluding to the lessons that are there from the Cold War in terms of how we handle this. And I would make one comment to follow on something that Steve Flanagan mentioned, and that is this idea that maybe we should coordinate this in the White House. During the Cold War, there was a special assistant to the president for public diplomacy, call it what you will. But I think all of us who've worked in the executive branch understand that without someone with direct access to the president who can push OMB and then push the cabinet secretaries, coordination is pretty much a fanciful idea. My question, though, is how do we inculcate this idea on both Capitol Hill and in the executive branch that we have to create our policies with their psychological impact in mind rather than just slapping a label on the policy after it's created?
If I could, I think we're getting there, and I think what you have to remember, and what I have some sympathy for, was post 9/11, and I really agree with this decision. Or I said, post 9/11, from everything I've read, I think the Bush administration did one thing absolutely right and one thing wrong. The one thing they did absolutely right was, we got to go. All right, we don't have time to be sitting around talking about how this is going to work. We have got to act, and we've got to respond, and we've got to move. I think the quick move into Afghanistan certainly made sense. I think the way they started targeting high-value targets, they didn't really have the time to sort of sit back and do the type of analysis that you just described, and I agree with that. You try to do it on the fly, and it didn't work too well. Now, I would say that it's been a while now, and we're a little behind the curve, I think, in sort of starting to think through our decisions in the way that you just described more. And I think we absolutely need to do it, to look at that broader impact from a strategic communication standpoint. And the only thing that I can think of that would help the most would be what you just described, having someone in the White House who's saying, guys, this is my area, and what you're doing here is really going to mess with it, because we don't right now. for the most part. And that's why I think what we're doing here and what people are talking about in this area is so important.
Yeah, I just affirm one of the things you said is somebody to push OMB. Push come to shove in the federal government, it's about the money. And having some way to influence the money that goes to different agencies so that they do not do their own thing is a key part of the challenge. Wherever it is, however it's done, influencing the money is critical. And on your question, I don't have a magic answer either. You know, thinking through longer term consequences of what we do, thinking about policies and you know, that sort of thinking beyond the next election is a challenge throughout our body politic. We clearly need to do better. I think some of these institutions, like Armed Services Committee in the House and the Senate, that last through administration to administration can help provide that guidance. But it's a huge challenge we face on everything Adam mentioned, healthcare, Social Security, you name it. We have that same issue.
Great, thanks. Yes, there was a question in the very last row there. Right in front of the camera.
Patrick Moore, the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy. I was wondering if you guys might address the challenges you faced in trying to target the religious aspect of this ideological war on terror in a country where we uphold the separation of church and state as one of our highest values. Specifically, if you could speak towards the madrasas, maybe in Pakistan, that oftentimes fuel groups like Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Thank you.
Well, Adam referenced earlier, and we cannot make a war on the religion of Islam. That is foolish, and we ought to be careful about the words we use and understand the meaning to the ear of the listener, not just the things that are in our minds when we are trying to communicate. And I mentioned earlier, you have to be humble about this stuff. The decision about how Islam will go will be made by Muslims themselves. We're not going to decide that for them. And that struggle that is, particularly in the past 6 to 9 months, that is coming up with other voices saying this is wrong, this is not jihad, to blow yourself up and kill a bunch of innocents with you. That sort of thing will be the deciding factor, and what one of the things we need to think about is how can we assist that in a truthful way that doesn't diminish the credibility of those clerics who make that decision. I do think it requires a deep understanding of the cultures you're dealing with in order for it to be effective.
Just a couple quick points. I think, first of all, in dealing with the religious aspects of it, that's why, and the State Department's come up with this, and I had, what you call them really matters a lot, to my mind. I remember having this debate with some folks in London, this was a couple years back, how they sort of arrived at the decision to call them Islamists. Because, they wanted to call them what they were, basically didn't want to get off of that, but figured, Islamist means it's not Islamic. And I'm like, I'm just pretty sure that the people in Pakistan are flipping through their dictionary going, oh, Islamist, that means that it's not really of it, it's just sort of like it. That doesn't work. And at the end of the day, it's very simple. They are violent extremists. The religion, at the end of the day, certainly there'll be a peace to it, but violent extremists, and mention Al-Qaeda. And I think that wording makes an enormous amount of importance. And the other point is that Mac has said, we are not in a position to lead the charge on this. We have to sort of stand back and find ways subtly to be helpful to the more moderate elements that are leading this debate. But the most dependable thing that our enemies have is to make it look like the U.S. is behind whatever is going on. I mean, this is part of the problem we have in Iran right now. The bulk of Iranians do not support their regime and actually have reasonably positive feelings towards the West, unless it looks like we are trying to force change in Iran. There's a big article by Seymour Hersh on this that, from what I understand, is primarily not true. But he was arguing that the White House was already starting to do sort of regime change operations within Iran to support local tribal groups that were opposed to the Iranians. And if true, it would be a big mistake, not because we wouldn't like to see the regime change in Iran, but because the biggest thing that's going to keep that regime in place is the perception that they are fighting against U.S. influence to displace them, because then it gives them a rallying point. So, you know, in terms of dealing with the religious aspects, you know, we really have to stand back and be very, very careful about leaving our fingerprints on it, because, you know, it is a different culture, and we are simply not in a favored position right now in any part of the Muslim world that I'm aware of.
This is, I think, really a critical point that I know a lot of the professionals that have been grappling with this problem in the government for the last several years, this notion of no matter how good the United States government gets its message, the idea of how do you get inside the narrative of the extremists, how do you undermine, and it's sort of this notion that Representative Thornberry touched on of if we can find validators within the communities who are speaking out against it and without getting too close to them and discrediting them. But I wondered, had you thought about how this Center for Strategic Communications, or do you think that the notion of this non-governmental organization working with the government can be helpful in identifying those voices and ways to get to them? Is that something that in your deliberations you've been talking about? It struck me that was an interesting innovation in all of this, and one that, you know, and I think it's not even just, I was just in South Korea, and I was remarking on, you know, it's not just in the extremist views in the world, but even getting all the good scientific evidence the United States government has gotten out about the safety of American beef, but yet you hear that, you find out that 80% of the South Koreans believe more what they hear on the internet or on their cell phone messages, because they figure reporters and government spokespeople are all on somebody's payroll, so they don't believe that. They believe what their fellow citizens are telling them. So how do you get inside these? It's not just an extremist narrative. It's even on scientific data we're finding that our positive message or our truthful message can't get through some of the noise.
Yeah. I think that's a great example. Most of our talk and discussion has been related to terrorism, of course. But the need in today's world to have a strategic communication capability is across the board in a whole variety of areas. And it's amazing to me that you can get 800,000 people marching in the streets of Seoul about beef. I'm in the cattle business, so I take this a little personally. It strikes a chord with me. I don't understand that. But I think your first point is exactly right. We cannot assume that the government is ever going to have all of the expertise and knowledge which is needed in these areas. So I think there has to be a mechanism in some way to take advantage of the enormous creativity and expertise that is out in the country. Now, this FFRDC may not be the magic answer, but it is, you know, one way, as I say, I borrow it from the Defense Science Board, to try to be able to have a way to plug in to take advantage of the polling or the whatever that the particular expertise may be. And I think it could be helpful in the ways you're talking about.
Yes, I'm sorry, this question over here in the corner.
Stephen Donahue from McLarty Associates. I just wanted to reinforce what you said, Congressman, about this being a worldwide issue, because we do have friends in Europe, Asia, Latin America, Africa, who have started to think that perhaps we don't wear the white hat anymore. And as we send these messages out, we not only change or help change that impression, but we also create an environment in which opinion leaders and political leaders can reinforce the decisions that we're making in other places.
And it would remind me of something I wanted to add. That's why I think, you know, in addition to diplomacy, the development piece of this is incredibly important, because while we struggle with the idea that, okay, if we come up with a great message that we think will work, if it looks like it's got our fingerprints on it, it's undermined, and you can sort of go, yeah, it just sort of freezes you. The one thing that has been clear is that when we go out into the world and simply help people, it has an incredibly positive reaction. The earthquake in Pakistan, the tsunami, even in parts of the world, just the whole, this guy who's going around Pakistan building schools, an American three cups of tea guy. You know, when you do that, it gets a positive reaction towards Western culture. And I think the other piece, which was not, you know, the subject here, is the development piece, because that's how you get around that. essentially, you know, we prospered as a nation in terms of the way the rest of the world looked at us. When the rest of the world sort of looked at America and said, they are spreading good things around the world. Now, granted, there was never a time when everybody felt that way, but that was sort of the, you know, sort of post-World War II consensus opinion, was that, you know, we were by and large helpful in a bunch of different ways. I think the consensus opinion right now is we are aggressively looking out for ourselves and the rest of the world, and we don't care who we step on in that effort. I'm not saying that's fair. I'm not going to get into an argument about how we got there or whatever. But I don't think there's much question that, by and large, in the world, that's the way they look at us. So if we want to get back to that other piece, in fact, I always remember this when I read From Beirut to Jerusalem, the Thomas Friedman book. And I think I read it post 9/11. Well, oh, gosh, now we got a problem here. I better figure this out. And in reading it, I remember when he talked about when the Marines went into Beirut in 1983. And a lot of history there, but the thing that really struck me was the way he described that almost everybody thought that was a good thing in Lebanon. The stock market went up, confidence went up, it went to hell a little while after that, but the initial impression was that the Marines are showing up, positive things are going to happen. And when I read that, I was like, wow, that was just 20 years ago. And that certainly is not going to be the opinion now. If we can sort of get back to that notion that America is here to help as much as to advance their own interests, it's going to help us. And I understand we have to advance our own interests. I understand that. But I think, you know, paradoxically, advancing those interests is in making the rest of the world realize that that isn't our primary concern.
And so we're going to go help people who have a hurricane or something. Are we smart about the way we communicate as we do so? I mean, we're doing, you know, remember, actions speak louder than words. We're doing the right actions, but are we smart about what we say and how we say it at the same time? I think that, and worldwide, I think that's the point.
Yes, ma'am, there's a question here in the second row.
Donna Reed from ARD, and I agree with you, Congressman, that development is absolutely key to what we're doing, but also that prior to recent history, our development didn't appear to be so tied to our political interests. And it was easier for us to make an impact with that and to be seen in a different way. And one of the concerns that I have being a development professional is also how our foreign assistance workers are being seen in the field and how we are being targeted more and more for assassinations and other forms of violence, which undermines our ability to perform our development work properly and also, you know, the credibility that we have. And the other concern that I have is the militarization of our foreign assistance and how we as development assistance workers can have as positive an impact as we would like to have when we are seen to be working, when the military is seen to be working and doing the same work that we do. Thank you.
I think those are certainly problems. Part of the reason, as I understand it, that aid workers are being more aggressively targeted is because, you know, our enemies in this case understand the value of it, and they're trying to shut it off. And they're just pure and simply trying to find ways to, you know, stop help from coming in from the West. And that's going to be a struggle, and it's going to be a fight without question. I think the one thing that would make a lot of sense for us to do is something that they did in Great Britain with the way they reorganized their development assistance approach and developing DFID, which I always forget what it stands for, but anyway, it's their cabinet level development assistance thing. And we met with them as well when we were over there, and they said there were two keys to the reorganization. One is something we've been talking about here on this subject, is they pulled it all together, put most of the money in that area, like 90%, so that they actually controlled it in one place and didn't spread it out over a bunch of different areas. But what you're talking about is more important. They made a point of saying we are decoupling our foreign assistance from all other policy objectives. Simply rewriting our Foreign Assistance Act to say that, I think, would have a very positive impact. And by decoupling, I mean our foreign assistance is for one purpose: to help the rest of the world develop. It is not to advance our commercial interests like, well, we do, but China has made an absolute, you know, living off of doing, or to advance necessarily any specific foreign policy objectives, to get that into the law and move forward. I think that would help the credibility of it, without question.
Maybe while we're on this point, I wondered, since you both are members of the Armed Services Committee, could you touch a little bit on what you see is the proper role of the military in this effort in terms of what should be the military's role in strategic communications, and also the question that does come up oftentimes is separating PSYOPs out from strategic communications and public affairs work. How should that be managed within the Department of Defense?
Well, I think it's interesting that among the loudest, strongest proponents of enhancing our other national capabilities has been Secretary Gates and folks in the military, because they don't want to continue to have the situation which we've had, which is the military is about the only arm of government that is able to do things in Iraq and elsewhere. So they have been very strong about more money, resources, people in diplomacy and other other areas of national influence, and I certainly think that is correct. But Department of Defense will always have an important role in this, particularly the communications that relate to military operations. They have done some of the most in-depth work, and we need to, as a country, take advantage of it and remember that they are part of the greater whole. To get back to my theme, you can't look at a tactical military situation in isolation. It has to be part of the national perception, or the way people perceive of us nationally, and so it has to be integrated. They will be a part of it.
And my bias, and I can be convinced otherwise, is I don't want to take the military completely out of what they're doing in this area. And I understand the criticism is, well, gosh, if the military's doing it, then it sends a very bad message to the people that we're helping. But there are actually many instances in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I went and visited the southern islands of the Philippines, where our special forces are involved, and what they're doing is more classic counterinsurgency. Part of counterinsurgency certainly is training, the local police force to deal with the military aspects of it. But a huge part of it is building schools, digging wells, passing out health care. One of the most effective things we've done is what they call a med cap, which is, you have a day when tell the villages all around all day long, we got doctors, we got nurses, come see us. And the guys, particularly within the special operations forces, this is what they're trained to do. They're trained in counterinsurgency. They're trained in medical and all of that. They're really good at it. And I think they have built very positive relationships with a lot of locals who don't see them, as just the guys kicking in doors and shooting people. They really see them as the guys who are helping them. And I wouldn't want to take away that tool. My initial bias is I believe that it can work. I suppose I could be convinced otherwise, but I certainly think it's working in a lot of places right now and want to keep it there.
Good. I think there's a question in the middle there.
Hi, I'm Brandon Carmack. I'm from the Heritage Foundation. And just a week ago, I was able to have a conversation with a man that just came back from Iraq. He's been there. He's been home for 2 months. And he shared many different stories with me in how the communications effort was helping or hindering over in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he talked, I don't want to take up too much time and tell some of his stories, but basically his point was that he felt like a lot of strategic communications efforts should be placed more towards the Army as they're doing more occupational work. And the Marines, he felt, have been really hindered in the type of work they're allowed to do. And because they can no longer kick in certain doors or go in and do different things in to men that they know are threats, they feel like America has lost a lot of respect in the Middle East. And he feels like they are no longer feared over there by the enemy. He said that the enemy is pushing their driving Humvees up as close as they can to our soldiers, seeing how far they can go before we'll shoot and different things. And he said, so he doesn't think they're going to listen to us. Whether or not we agree with him, my question is just a follow-up on what's been going on. How much are we listening to the men that are in uniform that are actually down there working with the Iraqi civilians as well as the enemy? It seems like between his story and to Congress, there's a lot of different venues that story's going to go through. It's going to get twisted. It's going to go to a lot of different places. Are we really including our men in uniform in on this effort for better communication in the Middle East?
Well, I can't speak for I am. I mean, we I represent Fort Lewis, a very large military base, and they've had a lot of folks deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, and I regularly meet and or communicate by email, and I get a lot of those stories. And it's, I think, one bit of information to help understand what's going on over there. You know, it's a more tactical, more, you know, anecdote piece by piece, but it's certainly helpful. Not always accurate. For one thing, you know, you'll get a lot of people who serve in the same area, maybe roughly same experiences, who have two totally different perspectives on it, as with any event. But certainly it's an area that we should tap in terms of information to figure out better what's going on.
And part of this, I think, relates to some of the things we've been talking about. First, you have to have a cultural awareness and understanding where you are. And certainly the military has made enormous strides in having cultural awareness teams as part of their units that are out there. You need to understand and listen before you can communicate. And so I think we have come a long way in that part. And so, for example, we've had hearings with some of those cultural awareness folks, what it's been like on the ground in Afghanistan and what they see as they try to do their job. And are there policy positions that come from on high that make it harder to do your job, to do what makes sense on the ground as you're carrying out operations? So, we have been hearing from some of them.
Yes, there's a question in the back row. Asta Banyanas.
Asta Banyanas with Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Back in the fall, Congressman, you had a hearing that had administration witnesses, actually Defense Department witnesses, talk about the need for creating public platforms to encourage moderation and debate. I apologize. That's my phone. The witnesses all endorsed something that came very close to what we would describe at Radio Free Europe as surrogate broadcasting. What did you think of their recommendations, and has there been follow-up?
I think it's fine. Personally, what I've found in that area to be more effective is exchanges of people, basically having, you know, whether it's students or professionals or whatever, doing exchanges between countries so that we get to know each other better. But you know, the broadcasts are tricky. You know, we've gone through the Al Ahura, I'm mispronouncing that, but anyway, the television that, you know, had some U.S. sponsorship that's broadcast in the Middle East, kind of a mixed record at this point in terms of being effective. It's difficult to dive into that medium. I will say this, and this is why I tried to sound a cautionary note on the Cold War analogy. It was a lot easier to deliver a message during the Cold War. I think the cultures were closer. As I facetiously put it, our message basically was, here's our grocery store, here's your grocery store, we win. And with the Muslim population, it's a lot more difficult. And in that sense, I think what we'd be better served is what, you know, Mac was talking about with some of the moderate, you know, Muslim, you know, if there's a way to help them with their voice as opposed to having a direct American stamp on the message. Now, again, as I frequently say, I can be corrected on that. Maybe someone can show me, okay, here's a model, here's what we can do. And I know there's a variety of different things going out there in terms of broadcasting. But it's tricky and difficult with this particular population.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is credibility of the messenger. And, you know, to go back to my basic definition, you look at the right message to the right audience to help effectively shape perceptions. And the question is, can a particular broadcast approach help be effective in helping shape perceptions to a particular audience? And I think it's going to be different in various parts of the world. And credibility of the messenger or the broadcast vehicle is going to be a key determinant of that.
Yes, I think we have a couple more questions. One in the back and then one over here.
I'm Michael Alpern from the State Department, and I work in the Europe Bureau. And we've seen a fairly amazing public diplomacy bump from the elections. And some of it is personal popularity of Obama and of McCain, and some of it is the election processes themselves are showcasing a really nice side of our democracy. And in the European press, they've noticed that. And I'm interested in what both your perspectives are from the Hill on if you've been taking note of these developments and if you think that is a sort of a temporary bump in that makes you a little more optimistic, or if you think that ongoing as you're trying to formulate sort of new policy toward PD and STRATCOM, if this is something to take into account and if the impending change of administration is affecting your perspective on that. I'm interested in what both of you have to say about that. Thanks.
You're going to hang back.
I thought he was. This is Mr. Obama over here. Of course, enormous benefits from having someone of Senator Obama's background, particularly in Africa and so forth. It makes a huge difference. I guess what I would like to do, though, is to build a lasting. There are going to be ups and downs depending on events. You know, the down is Abu Ghraib. Maybe the up is the presidential campaign. There will be lots of ups and downs. We need a lasting capability that can help us navigate through these ups and downs so that we minimize the downs and maximize the ups. I think that's what we're talking about, something that lasts. I do think a new administration, whoever it turns out to be, gives us an opportunity to have a fresh look, a new emphasis, a little reorganization as necessary to move this along. It's one of the reasons I appreciate the attention that it's receiving now, because I do think it's a chance to do better, do more, and strategic communications needs that chance.
I agree with that, particularly, the last part that's changed. And, the charitable way to put it from my perspective is, as I said, post 9/11, we had to do some things fairly quickly. It's just nice now to have a break. It's like a timeout in a game, if you will. We get a new administration in there. We can sort of look at what we did right, what we did wrong, rebuild some of those relationships, so that we can sort of just go forward and get past some of the difficulties or have the opportunity to. But I agree with Matt, and I don't think we should kid ourselves. It's, as I've taken to telling people, believe it or not, everything that's wrong with the world is not suddenly going to be right when George Bush leaves office. Not going to happen. It is not, in fact, all his fault. And we're going to need to work on it in a broader way. I will say, and, shameless plug to a certain extent, but I also think it's true, that the psychological impact of us just having nominated an African-American, they've developed, and it's in Europe and it's elsewhere, it's all over the place, this preconceived notion of what America is, that we're racist, that, we are not inclusive, that we're elitist, that we're all these different things, and nothing shatters that more, like Barack Obama being one of our major nominees out there, and it does help give us an opening, but I can assure you that a week or a month after he's in office, they'll be moving on to other issues that we better be prepared to deal with.
Yes, maybe in the second room.
Rhonda Freiberg, I was with USIA and the State Department in the last administration and taken a real interest in all of the discussions about how we ought to reorganize public diplomacy and strategic communications. I wanted to add one phrase to the very apt statement that Congressman Thornberry used throughout the discussion about having the right message through the right medium. I would add to that with the right people. And I think as we in Washington look at various ways of restructuring strategic communications or public diplomacy, and as we start looking at boxes on an organization chart, we should also not neglect the cadre of people who are going to be carrying out this very difficult task, who have been doing so for years, many of them. How are we going to attract the talent, the skills, and the experience we need, not just in Washington, not just running agencies back here, but out in the field? The analogy that I use is the grassroots team of our foreign policy. Special skills are needed to communicate with foreign publics, and I think we too often neglect the personnel side of this effort. So thank you very much.
I would just say quickly on that, I think and Secretary Gates has made this point. You know, I think the State Department needs to crank up those efforts, and they need the money to do it. They need the resources to do it to really train those people. And that's why also I made the reference to the, you know, special ops guys on the DOD side. That's kind of what they're being trained to do now, is to go out and have that cultural sensitivity and language training and understanding. We need that, you know, same thing on the State Department side, and I know it's there to some extent, but expand it. I think, you know, getting that personnel in place is critical.
Yeah, and I just emphasize that grassroots is even more important when communication moves at the speed of light. You don't have time to get an assistant secretary to sign off on the latest posting to the website. You got to have the right person there to put it up right away in order to be effective. And so that just emphasizes your point. You got to have the right person in place and give them the authority to make some of these decisions and to communicate at the speed that the internet requires.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Let's see if our members have some parting comments they'd like to make. I want to just thank them first of all for making time to come downtown and deliver this report on their work, and to thank them also for their leadership on this issue. Mr. Smith, Representative Thornberry, and Mr. Representative Smith, we wish you best of luck in your in the legislative efforts. And I guess this bill has moved into conference now. The amendment will be in conference soon. So we wish you success with that, and please join me in thanking both Representative Smith and Thornberry.